might seem like a really obvious thing to say, but I really believe that the key to any successful acting career is versatility. And today's guest is nothing if not versatile. He's a musician, a singer, an actor, and is equal at home with Shakespeare as he is with Sondheim. His career has taken him from huge wrestling juggernauts like Les Mis to up-close and personal spaces like the Union Theatre in Southwark, and most recently in the original London production of Jez Butterworth's The Ferryman. It's Fra Fee. Hello, Fra. How are you?
How's it going, Kirk?
Yes, very well. Thank you. Nice of you to ask. So, how was The Ferryman? You've just left, is that right?
Yeah, I departed the show on the 6th of January. I mean, it sounds like a real cliche to say, but it just was one of those incredible projects that I feel very, very lucky to have been a part of. Laura Donnelly, who played Caitlin in the production originally, who's Jez's partner, we had a chat about it actually when we were rehearsing. She said, these jobs come along once in a while where at the end of it, you absolutely just turned a corner in some way.
So it's been a milestone for you.
Absolutely, yeah. For many reasons. I mean, I think you very rarely get the quality of writing that Jez can produce, you know, very often. Mm. And to originate it, and the fact that it's set from, you know, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. The play is set in County Armagh. I grew up in County Tyrone, just next to it. It just felt very significant, the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
Did you guys know, because it started at the Royal Court, didn't it? Did you know when you were putting it together? I mean, obviously Sam Mendes was attached, and as you mentioned, incredible writing. Did you guys have a feeling really early on that it was going to be this kind of huge hit?
It seems a bit so big-headed to say, but I did, yeah. I personally did anyway. But not because of, you know, my involvement in it or anything, but the very first time I read it, I was invited to do a read-through of it maybe a year and a half ago, maybe now, or over that, in fact, almost 2 years ago. And two-thirds of the play was written, and Sonia had assembled just a random group of Northern Irish actors just to read through this thing. Mm-hmm. And even without the incredible ending, for those that have seen the play, and even without knowing it, I just thought it was one of the best things I'd ever read. Mm-hmm. At that stage, a different director was attached to Ian Rickson. And then when Sam came on board, and you've just got these two, you know, powerhouses of theatre and film coming together, it just felt like a very, very obvious mm-hmm. hit was in the making, you know? I guess there was a little bit of scepticism in terms of the material. I wasn't really sure if an English audience would take to what is a really Irish story. Mm-hmm. But I was very, you know, pleasantly surprised. It's been such a huge, huge show.
And it's just extended as well.
Yes, but it's playing until May something, I believe, May 19th, with Rosalie Craig.
Yeah.
I considered for all of maybe 3 seconds staying on for this extension when Rosie said she was doing it.
Well, that's funny, actually. It was something I was going to ask you a little bit later, but let's talk about it now as you brought it up. What was the decision not to stay? I mean,
I don't know. It's very long. And because of the nature of the contract, ordinarily, if you accept a 12-month job, you know, which I've done before, you have your 4 weeks holiday to look mm-hmm. forward to, and you can plan your trip home, or you right. can plan your week in France to yeah. recuperate and come back to work.
France, you're fancy. Go on.
Yeah. or wherever, you know, Brighton. But in this instance, because it was just extended, there was no real holiday as such.
Oh, I see.
And it's tiring, you know, working in the West End is really, really exhausting. The one day off a week just is less and less enough time mm-hmm. to recuperate every week. Mm-hmm. So I was tired, and I was quite happy to sort of hand over this wonderful thing to someone else to do mm-hmm. for a bit.
Well, that leads me actually onto another question that I was kind of thinking about on my way here today. Because, as you said, you did create this role, and this mm-hmm. is an original production that kind of you were part of. What's it like to hand that over to someone else? Do you feel a bit of a pang of, oh, don't ruin it, it's mine?
It's hard to say. Not really.
It's funny you say that. I mean, that's nice to hear.
Yeah.
But I know actors who have taken that extension and who have done it until the show closes, because the thought of handing it over to someone else or the thought of seeing someone else do it is too difficult for them.
I know actors that are like that as well. And even bizarrely, actors that have just been playing a role that has already existed for many, many, many years, but they will just cling on to it for a long time. Mm. And, you know, each to their own, of course, but I don't really think a part is there for anyone to own. You know, you can't be possessive of these things. I was very lucky to have done it for the first time, but, you know...
And you'll always be the original, so...
My name's at the front of the play, in the book, I'm thrilled.
It's so amazing, isn't it? Because I love that, when you buy a play and it says originally performed. And that'll always be you, that's quite cool.
Yeah, that's really, really cool, isn't it? And, I didn't feel too bothered. Perhaps if it had happened much earlier on, but I did it for a long time, just shy of a year, the whole thing.
It's time to move on, isn't it, after that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's healthy.
And have you gone and seen the other person? Have you got to see the new cast?
No. I haven't.
You're not comfortable with it, then.
The reason why I haven't is I just quite happy to have a little bit of a break from the piece.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely going to go see. As I say, I'm a very good friend with Rosie Craig, who did As You Like It with her at the National. Mm-hmm. Know her husband very well, Hadley. And the part is particularly wonderful because it was originally, as I said, written for Laura Donnelly, Jez's partner, and it was based a little bit on her own personal experiences. Her uncle was disappeared by the IRA, her uncle Eugene. So he was executed, buried in a bog, and his body was found, and that sort of formed the inspiration for the beginning of this story. So I mean, it's not entirely autobiographical, but it's very much
elements of it.
It was written for her, her story, and I guess there's a real sense of responsibility for Sarah, who then played it, and now Rosie. It's a very special role, you know,
but you've got to look after something when you're playing that part. And you talked about the fact that you were born in Ireland as well, as if anyone couldn't figure that out for themselves. Did it resonate differently for you, do you think, because you were...
It was an interesting experience for me, because the play is set in 1981. I was born in 1987, but the Troubles were still technically taking place for the first few years of my life. I remember one particular instance. I remember a helicopter landing in my back garden as I was playing swing ball, and just this group of British soldiers coming out and marching up and down the streets, in my little rural to the countryside home, which seems really, really bizarre. But do you know what it actually? I've been watching Derry Girls. I don't know if you've been watching Derry Girls on Channel 4. I think it's brilliant. It's so wonderfully irreverent, and it actually paints a wonderful picture of what it's like to grow up in that environment, because you're still a kid and you're still playing swing ball. The fact that there's like British soldiers coming out of helicopters, neither here nor there.
Taking a stride a bit.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, that's annoying. It's affecting my swing. But I felt somewhat sort of outside of the situation, and I wish I actually knew a wee bit more about my place in history at that time, my place of where how I identify as an Irish person, et cetera, you know? So the play opened up a lot of that, and it opened up conversation, which was very, as I say, cathartic, beneficial. And
obviously your parents have seen it.
Of course, and my aunties and uncles, of which I have many. They're from the Catholic Republican neighborhoods in Northern Ireland. And so, it resonated with them. And a lot of, one particular critic thought it didn't ring true, the play, but actually I was glad that my family thought it absolutely did, just with a nice sort of pinch of poetry and lyricism and sort of dramatic.
Well, that critic is probably on their own, because I haven't met anyone who doesn't think it's the most brilliant thing that they've seen.
He very much was on his own. People just like to
stir the pot on it. So you spoke a little bit about your parents before, so tell me a bit about your background. How do you get into, so from watching helicopters landing in your back garden, how How did you find theatre, or how did it find you? What was that path? Were your parents theatrical at all?
Yeah, my dad is an extremely literary person. He reads a lot, and he does amateur dramatics back at home. It's a huge thing in Ireland. It's actually mental. And particularly, you know, at that time, there was no real professional in-house productions taking place. And there was the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, and then the Abbey and the Gate Theatres in Dublin. And that's sort of it. So amateur dramatics is a big thing. He doesn't sing at all, but he's a really fine actor. And he would do, you know, productions of Brian Freed and Martin McDonagh and Harold Pinter plays, and, you know, all the classic stuff. And I went to see it all. I went to watch it all and just really fell in love. So he sort of introduced drama into my life, I suppose. My sisters also sang. I've got three older sisters. And one in particular, Claire, was doing a production of Blood Brothers at her all-girls school, playing Mickey.
What an interesting choice for an all-girls school.
Yeah, I know. They did West Side Story.
A story about two brothers.
Yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it? The following show was West Side Story, when she was playing Tony.
Right.
But she played Mickey in Blood Brothers, and I went every single performance. I must have been six, maybe. I was really young, but just was completely hooked by it. And I remember I wanted to be an actor from a very, very young age. It sort of meandered a little bit as I sort of got older and started and discovered my singing voice and stuff. It's been a part of my life, I guess, since I was very, very young.
And then, of course, you chose to kind of pursue it, and you came over here to train. Now, you trained initially in music.
Yeah, I did a music degree in Manchester.
So when you were training in music, did you know that you wanted to be an actor? Or was that a moment where you thought, actually, I could go into music here?
To be honest, I just wasn't quite sure at that stage. I primarily did a music degree because I hadn't made my mind up when I was at school.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of doing vocal studies. At one point, I thought I might conduct choirs. Acting. I just didn't quite know. And then at university, I had 3 years to sort of make up my mind. And I was doing so much singing and acting at the same time. And I guess it just seemed like an obvious thing to merge the two and do musical theatre as a postgrad afterwards.
Did you do a musical theatre postgrad or an acting postgrad?
Musical theatre. At the Royal Academy of Music.
Because it seems like to me that you are a musician and an actor, and that those two things have kind of come together in musical theatre. But it seems to me like you have the more kind of classic background in both disciplines.
Yeah.
That's what kind of comes across to me.
Well, certainly music-wise, I would have had a more classical upbringing. You know, did classical singing and all, and did an academic music degree. If I could do it all again, I probably would have done it a little bit differently, but
did you feel like you missed out on the fame experience?
No, I don't think I would have gone to do musical theatre at drama school. I think I may have done acting for 3 years. But it's hard to say. If I was guided or had sort of a mentor to sort of help me figure it out better, because it's very much on my own, and I just figured, I sing and I act. This is an obvious choice.
Yeah.
And I had a very, very lovely time with it.
Do you feel, when you got out into the business and you started working, did you feel that you'd kind of missed out on anything? Or that almost that you kind of, because if you go to university and you do music, and then of course you do the postgrad, but you missed out on that 3 years at drama school. And, you know, and I have a friend, one is specifically coming to mind, and she didn't train at all, but she's very, very successful in musical theatre. And there's something about her personality which, because she didn't go to drama school, it's always just something slightly different to the ensemble or to the ensemble, the company. Did you feel anything like that?
Mm, I guess a little bit. I love rehearsing and I love talking about plays and acting and really just talking very pompously about art. I think I would have really, really enjoyed 3 years of acting training. I don't think I would have been able to stick a musical theatre one. I mean, I teach at several drama schools and musical theatre courses, and I just know I wouldn't have been made for it. I teach singing and acting through song.
What's your dancing like?
Not good.
No.
Not good. No. Okay. For that very reason.
You're not known for your dancing, are you, Frog? You're not known for your dancing.
No, I did start off doing very dancey shows, but in non-dancing parts.
Okay.
Yeah, my first job was Dirty Dancing. Is that not in your little notes?
I'm going to be honest, I did spot it on your...
And you thought it must have been some sort of typo.
But, you know, I just thought I'd leave it out. Yeah. I just thought I wouldn't kind of argue about it too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I
did notice Fame on there as well.
Yeah, that was the second gig. Yeah, yeah.
So, as you brought it up, let's talk about Dirty Dancing.
There's not much to say. Like, I mean, the Dirty Dancing thing, I was at the Academy. A friend of mine from uni, who I did music with, her mum is a casting director, Irene, and she called me up one day and said, I think I've got an audition for you for this thing. And she was talking for about 10 minutes and saying, it's great, and you'll sing, and I think you're the right personality, and you've got the right look. And just before she hung up, I was like, oh, sorry, one last thing. What is it for? And said, Dirty Dancing. And I practically snorted down the phone. But I thought I would go and just get the first audition nerves out of the way. And then sort of accidentally got the job and was just so thrilled to have been offered money to like sing and act a little bit. I'll absolutely do it, you know? So it was an odd little baptism of fire. Very, very odd. But you know, it was the start of something, I guess.
Yeah, and you like it seems to me as someone who's kind of knows what various people are up to in the business. It seems to me like your career's taken quite a drastic turn since the Fame days, the Dirty Dancing days. Did you know when you were doing it? And I don't want to kind of boo-hoo those jobs because I'm going to be honest, Mamma Mia isn't my idea of a good night out, but Mamma Mia isn't there for me. It's catering for someone else.
Yeah.
And it should absolutely have a place within the West End. It totally deserves to be there. And I think the first time I saw it, I probably quite liked it.
Yeah.
But did you know when you were doing those things that that wasn't the journey you wanted to take?
Yes, I did. I still had a very good time. I was thrilled to be working in the West End, and I met a lot of very, very nice people. But no, it wasn't what I wanted to be doing necessarily. But I guess I just trusted in the stepping stone thing.
You certainly took a step in the right direction after that, because you went on to Les Mis.
Which is, if I had to name one show when I was, a teenager that I wanted to do, it would have been that.
I spoke to Alice Fern earlier on in the series, and she said exactly the same thing. She said that Les Mis was the show that she aspired to do when leaving drama school. And I imagine that what she said then was quite similar to you as well. Once she'd achieved that dream, it then forced her to make new dreams, and it forced her, because she'd achieved, I've done Les Mis, great.
Yeah.
So then it all of a sudden forced her to go, okay, now what do I actually want to do? Because I've got to maintain this career for the next 40 years.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Was it a similar thing for you? Once you ticked it off the list, you kind of started to go, oh, okay, I need to stay interested.
Yeah, I guess so. The thing is, you can never really plan where you want to be, sort of be where you're actually going to end up in this game, because actors have very little control really about what they do. You can make decisions that, of course, would help inform the route that you take, but ultimately, one thing just naturally leads to another, and you could be ending up doing something you've never planned to do. And with Les Mis, I had the best time ever doing the stage show. But of course, I was cast in the movie at the same time. And was shot it for whatever 6 weeks towards the end of my West End contract, and that just opened up a whole new world to me.
I don't know whether it's insulting to say this to you, but I feel like that really put you on the map in terms of, that's certainly when you came to my attention, because a lot of people, you were so featured in that film, more than that character normally is, right?
Yeah
And it felt like you, like they, there was a certain group of people in the students, a certain group of them that they chose to kind of focus on as the core of students. That must have been amazing. Yeah. You must have been thrilled.
I was really, really thrilled. I mean, I got the screenplay through and I could see that this character, Kofrak,
who
goes for nothing in the stage show, essentially, was just really sort of beefed up in, with the material. And often the relationship that Gavroche has with Grantaire in the stage show was transferred over to Kofrak in the film. So I was, it was very, very, very exciting. I'm very, very lucky to have done it, because I guess I agree. It was another real big turning point.
So you recognize that things did kind of take a shift after that?
Yeah, I think so. Not terribly dramatically, but yeah, I guess there was definitely a real turning point for sure. And personally, you know, as you say, in terms of aspirations and what I wanted to do, it excited me. It inspired me. It made me think, okay, I want to do more of this as well. And I hadn't really considered the whole sort of film and television thing. It was a wonderful thing for me to have done and to sort of inspire me to go forward.
And what was the experience of working on that film like? I mean, aside from the actual shooting of it, what was it like being part of something that big, that kind of globally people had an opinion on, people were waiting to see, there was anticipation, there was good reviews, there was bad reviews. What was it like kind of navigating that experience?
I mean, there was no question how big it was going to be. You know, you're already involved in an absolute phenomenon. Oddly, you shoot the thing for X number of weeks and you're working with the same group of people and a relatively small amount of people. You know, there's crew, there's some extras, and there's this core group of students, and then you leave it for 6 months. And then when it opens, that's when everything just sort of blows up, you know? So that was a bit of an odd experience, you know, because you didn't necessarily experience the whole...
It wasn't as one, it was kind of two separate
occasions.
And what was it like during the kind of dip, just anticipating that you knew it was going to blow up? Is that weird?
I did a winter's tale
You were busy, you filled your time.
Yeah, it was a tiny little fringe theatre. What do you call that one in Clapham? Is it there anymore?
Was it the Lando?
Yeah. It's like a tiny little hard good old thing.
I think it went away and came back.
Right.
I think it's back now.
I was doing like a tiny little show in front of 50 people.
And so from a huge, huge Hollywood blockbuster to a room.
Yeah.
What does that do to your head? Is it a good thing?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, my agent at the time, we were thinking, oh, we have to wait for the right thing here, you know, after doing this film, which... By and large, I'm happy with, and I'm certainly more content sort of waiting for the right project. Like back then, like I'd only really worked for a few years, and I was just keen to do stuff. So eager, you know, bored quite easily. So when this sort of hard, good old musical came along, and I'm a big fan of his work, I'm doing it. I don't care if there are three people in the audience, I'm going to do it. And I think, it sort of keeps your feet firmly in the ground, I suppose.
But it's not the only time you've done that, because you've gone from these kind of big shows and then you have done the smaller stuff. Like, I know I saw you doing The Fix at the Union, which was the first show at the new venue.
Yeah.
But that was kind of straight off the back of much bigger stuff.
Yeah, just an As You Like It, I think, at the National.
So what what kind of aids those decisions? What helps you make those decisions? Is it the part? Is it the venue? Is it to challenge yourself and go, do you know what? I want to do a small space, because, I mean, obviously I've directed at Union quite a few times, and for me, what I notice is that there are, you can't hide behind anything as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, you're not amplified, you're not wearing a mic, you don't have huge amounts of set to hide behind. So you are really forced to kind of go back to kind of acting 101.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what attracts a lot of people. Mm. So what is it about those things that attract you?
Yeah, I mean, all those things and more. When I first moved to London, I saw loads of things at the Union. It was one of my favourite spaces. It still is. I love Fringe Theatre, and I love particularly seeing musicals done that intimately.
Yeah,
it's so interesting. It just completely redefines them. It's a form that's by nature a spectacle and grandiose, and to just have. Yeah, but to strip it right down to just what actually the actors are doing on stage is really, really exciting. And I'd seen The Fix before at the other, you know, across the street with Louis Maskelpin, and I love Louis, he's so class. And I just thought it was a really brilliant character and really damaged and sad, and I just empathized with him, and I thought, yeah, I want to give this a go. Why not?
So it's the roles that attract you then?
Yeah, the role and the piece. I really, really liked the story. I thought the musical was largely brilliant. But yeah, I particularly liked the character. He was very interesting.
And then kind of, I don't know whether it was before or after you did The Fix, but you also did the original production of Wind in the Willows, which was The Stars and Drew.
Yeah, it's just after that, actually.
Oh, was it? So it was just after. So you kind of knew you were going into that.
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that in some way affected your desire or your availability to do that? Because when you know you're going into something, when you know something's coming up, you kind of want to fill that gap. Does that ever affect?
Sometimes. I can't actually remember if I had been cast in Wind in the Willows before setting The Fix or not, to be honest. I mean, I'd be lying if I said, you know, the money doesn't come into it. You know, you don't earn a lot of money, if any, doing these smaller productions. With Wind in the Willows, I would have had a sort of guaranteed decent enough wage to sort of get me through X number of months. So perhaps that did affect my decision, because you have to be realistic as well. Mm. And, you know, The Fix was over the summer months. I can't teach over the summer months because the schools aren't open. And so, yeah, it very may well have.
So what was the experience of Winning the Willows like? Because obviously it was an original production. It was the first time this musical had been performed anywhere. Stars and Drew were quite hot.
Absolutely. You know,
they'd done Mary Poppins, they'd done Honk, they'd done Betty Blue Eyes. What was that experience like? Because you were playing pretty much one of the two lead characters.
Yeah.
You were Mole, right?
Mole, yeah. Yeah, the whole story is really told through Mole's eyes, as it were. I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, I was so keen to do it because I'd never done an original musical before. Again, it was a sort of bucket list thing that I wanted to do, and I wanted to know what that creative process would have been like. It's a big fan of George and Anthony's writing. Very, very British, quintessentially British and all that. And I had a really fun time. I loved the people that I was working with. Rufus and Sophia, Neil McDermott, all those ones. And, you know, when you're on tour, I mean, it was a very, very short tour, granted, but, you know, there's just a very, very lovely camaraderie and family feeling that you get when you're doing that.
So where did it play? I know it played in Manchester.
It opened in Plymouth and went to the Lowry in Salford, Manchester, yeah, and Southampton.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And was that, because of course we now know the play ended up, the show ended up going to the Palladium. Was that a kind of purposeful out-of-town tryout?
It was, yeah.
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 Do you think that's useful to try something away from the West End before you open it, though?
Yeah, absolutely. I went to see it then in the West End.
Well, yeah, that brings me on to the next point that you didn't transfer. But what was your thoughts of the, once it got there?
I mean, obviously, I was it was a bit of a no-brainer to do the Fairy Mountain for me, but I still was very sad that I couldn't do the Wind in the Willows in town, because I had such a lovely time doing it and felt very connected to this piece and this very, very adorable little character that I sort of fell in love with. The show I thought was beautiful, and they had changed quite a bit, so I think the out of town tryout was
worth it.
Absolutely worth it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, musicals are just so hard to pinpoint what makes it successful or not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even harder than a play. There's just so much that needs to come together in a perfect, mm-hmm. perfect collision. And I think the West End version was gorgeous and much, much better because of having done the out of town tryout.
I haven't seen a producer spend that much money on a new musical in a very long time.
Mm.
They threw a lot at that, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it felt really sumptuous and really kind of, you know, quite opulent, and sitting in the playroom as well. It was just such a nice thing to see, you know, British writers, new writing. It was lovely.
Mm.
And so that does kind of answer my question that I was going to ask. That you, so you knew you had the Ferryman then, which is why you didn't do the transfers.
So I had been, as I said, I was involved in a very, very early reading of the Ferryman the previous year. Mm. I never actually thought I would be in it because I thought I was too old to play one of the teenage lads. But then I auditioned, or did a tape when I was on tour, and then I had a meeting with Sam. The offer for the West End, Wind in the Willows, came in, and then I sort of had a few weeks before an offer for the Ferryman officially came through, because there was another read through with a full assembled cast, etc.
That's a nice position to be in, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful. I say it's wonderful. It's actually heartbreaking as well, you know. As I say, I so desperately wanted to do both, because I felt a real attachment to having just done The Wind in the Willows, and my friends were going to still be doing it, and Neil and Rufus and stuff. And it was sort of heartbreaking, you know. But, you know, obviously, I was going to do the Ferryman. There was no question, but it's still as nice a situation as it is for an actor to be in, you know, to have that sort of conundrum. It's still a bit, it pains you a little bit.
And you spoke a bit about you did these read throughs and, you know, you kind of, I guess, workshops or kind of maybe.
Yeah, the initial one 2 years ago would have been for the benefit of jazz, really, just to hear it and for the structure of the whole thing. After meeting with Sam for the first time, which was just a general chat, we then read the whole script and we had a cast assembled. So there was no real audition.
Well, that was what I was going to say, because you'd done these read throughs and so you didn't then have to go on and do an official audition.
No, just, I mean, Sam hates auditioning people. Right. He said that. He finds it very, very awkward. Mm. And you can never really do the text service, really, because it's an unnatural situation. Mm. So he assembled a version of the cast that he thought might work. And we all sat around the table and we just opened it up and we just read this, we just told this story. Mm. And I think after that first one, maybe about half of the cast were half of the people were cast. And then there was a second read through when I'd already accepted my offer and when they sort of found everyone else. Mm. But it's a very lovely way to audition. If only they were all like that.
Yeah, because you know, I mean, as a director, you sit on panels quite a lot. It is such a false environment, and it's so difficult to get the best out of someone, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
you're
essentially giving them 3-4 minutes to prove themselves. And also, when they're doing material from the play or the musical, they don't know it. They don't know it well enough. You know, that's what rehearsals are there for.
Absolutely.
Julie Atherton did this podcast that I was speaking to her last week, and one of her things is she always says, I don't know the play. I can't give you a finished version of the product. Yeah. That's the point of rehearsal.
Of course.
So that does sound like quite a nice...
Oh,
and also a really nice way to get a part in terms of, you know, it's with Sam Mendes, it's this huge new play, and you kind of just...
Yeah.
Slip into it.
It's lovely. It's lovely. I didn't have to... at no point was I really, really nervous, you know, because when you're just reading a script, I mean, there's a big wigs in the room, but it's okay because you're playing opposite actors and you're just telling the story. It's not, as I
said, a real acting environment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. So it was great. And just some of the talent in that room was amazing. Just really, like, old school Irish greats that were in there, you know, that ended up doing the play as well. Dervla Molloy and Breed Brennan. They were both in the original cast of Dancing at Lunasa, Brian Freeland's play. And it was just wonderful. It was just amazing.
Well, where can people find you, Frank, if they want to kind of look you up? Are you into the social media?
Yeah, I am, unfortunately.
Why is it so unfortunate?
Because it wastes so much time on it.
Yeah.
Instagram's a new thing for me.
So I think Instagram is specifically for people who are kind of 22 and under. I don't get it.
I don't take that many photographs. Mm. You know, I don't take photographs of my food.
Yeah.
I guess I should really be taking a picture of me and you here, shouldn't I?
I wouldn't be offended if you didn't do that. Actually, that's slightly awkward. Getting his phone out.
Twitter's more my thing. But let me take a... Because this is what Instagram people would do, isn't it?
What, like, take it as we're...
Yeah, as we're doing it. There we go. There we go. Lovely. Great. There we go. So I'm going to put that on Instagram.
Okay, great.
But Twitter's more my
thing. So where can people find you?
Yeah, on Twitter primarily. I do have a website. It hasn't been updated in about 3 years.
Do you remember what your Twitter handle is? Can we do that?
_fee, I think.
Okay, great. Yeah. Good. Well, thanks
for... Or Fra-fee, maybe? One or the other.
They'll find it. Just type Fra-fee.
There's definitely no other Fra-fee, though, for sure.
That's for sure. Mm. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Fra. It's been really, really lovely to talk to you.